I chose the title, Humanity at the Crossroads, because I feel that we are rapidly reaching a crossroads. The world is full of so many problems, many of them probably much more serious than most people realize. And the fact is, as far as I can see, unless we bestir ourselves and really start understanding the problems to try to do something about them, we may have a very unhappy future, or certainly we risk a very unhappy future. We all go to church on Sundays, I suppose, or many, many do. Anyway, we're all conditioned by Christianity, and we have some kind of an idea of God and the sort of God we would like to worship, we've been brought up to worship, and so on. A God of love, of understanding, brotherhood, compassion, and so on. But in point of fact, when you look at the world we're in dispassionately, you look at the city of London or at Wall Street in New York and comparable places in other great cities of the world, they're not worshipping the God of love, are they? The whole of the energy of all those business people, from the relatively poor who are caught up in the same economic system to the very rich, are concerned with really worshipping the gods of money and the gods of mammon and the gods of status, gods of power, selfishness, greed, and so on. This is, after all, a fact. There are lots of people involved in all that who are very nice people. They probably love their wives and children. They're very nice in a certain way. But they have a sort of dichotomy in their lives. And they don't perhaps realize that with the other half of themselves, they're contributing to the downfall, the eventual downfall of our system and our planet. The American astronauts did a wonderful job for us, I believe, when they showed us that photograph of the little blue Earth arising over the landscape or the horizon of the moon. And I think any thoughtful person must have thought, on looking at that photograph, gosh, that's our Earth. That's where we are. That little thing in the vastness of heaven. Just that. And that's where I live. And where you live. And where everyone else lives. This is our home in space. It is our planet. Unfortunately, but inevitably, it has a certain size. And because it has a certain size, it has its limitations. It's therefore up to us to do everything we can to try and perpetuate it, to try and do everything which helps it, and not to do the things which destroy it. Doesn't that make sense? And yet, so many things are happening in our world today which are directly, really, undermining and destroying not only the fabric, but also the attitude of people. So I feel we're coming to a crossroad when we look at all the tremendous problems of the world, and we've got to decide which way we're going to go. And it's no use leaving this just to a few leaders. Whatever you may think of democracy, democracy has a certain power. You saw that the other day in the Indian elections when Mrs. Gandhi was thrown out of office. It was the people who used their votes. The power of the people is great. Greater, really, than the powers of the leaders very often in certain emergencies. What are we going to do about it? What are you going to do? What am I going to do? Well, we have to look at the scene, I think. We have to be very well aware, as far as we can, through our reading and our contacts, of what is actually happening. It is an interesting fact that there should be such a thing as that group which calls itself the Club of Rome. It has published more than one book. The first was called The Limits of Growth, meaning that there were limits to the possible growth that we expect. Often in the field of economics, people are prophesying growth, 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 growth. There is a limit to growth, so we are told by these people, who call themselves free scientists, not particularly beholden to any government or any special research group. And they have set out to discuss the question, which to my mind is extraordinarily fundamental. What could in fact be more fundamental than this question? And it is nothing less, in so many words, is it possible or not for humanity to continue to live on this planet? Is it possible? They feel that the situation of the world is so near to a point of no return that they are actually investigating the situation and wasting, if you like to call it wasting, or spending, if you like to call it spending, their energy, their time, and their money on trying to find out. Now, if a group of scientists, who no doubt could be more remuneratively employed in other fields, are so concerned that they do this, I think at least we should try to understand what they're getting at. They talk of five factors: production, resources, pollution, population, and food. And these are the five things they think affect our future more than anything else. You can see how they're all interrelated. You can't solve one problem without affecting one or the other of these five factors. And they are unhappy on the whole. The computers with which they have been working are unhappy about the results. Well, I mention that not because I think that their findings are ultimate findings. They may have forgotten to put into the computer certain data which should be there. They may have overlooked the resilience of human character, which can overcome its difficulties, and so on. But the fact remains that here are a group of responsible people looking into this extraordinary fundamental question, which affects you and me and everybody else on our planet. And yet, the majority of people don't seem to me to show any particular concern. The vast number of people, for whatever reason, live in a small cycle. When I was a child, I had a mouse in a cage, and in his cage he had a whirligig affair, and a sort of cylinder that revolved, and he could get into it through a little hole, and then he would run round inside, and you've probably seen these things. And the mouse went round and round and round and round and round and round, spent a great deal of time and energy getting nowhere, staying in the same place. Well, most people are doing that. Slaves as we are of the system we have created, no one else created it. You and I created it, men created it. It is our system, we made it, and we are now the slaves of it, because we're all caught in this economic whirligig. And so most people just go round and round and round, don't get anywhere at all, and are not basically very concerned about what's happening. The newspapers of the world will give much more time to sport, much more time to film stars, much more time to things that are not basically of importance to our planet, perhaps, although they may be interesting to you and me. You may be interested in cricket, why not? And you may be interested in film stars, why not? But the basic things are not normally of greatest interest to the vast majority of people, because I think we are so conditioned. And it is this lack of responsibility that I feel is one of the crying dangers of today, that the average person is not concerned to protect his planet from what may be happening to it. He doesn't even have the sufficient interest to find out what is happening to it. And if you take any particular field, take pollution, for instance, which is as a traveler, I can say you see pollution everywhere. Isn't a place where you don't see and hear about pollution. It's a world problem, and a terribly dangerous one, especially as the ocean is being affected by it. And if the ocean got to a point of no return, then there would be no hope for any of us. It hasn't got to that. But the experts on the ocean do all they can to inform us. But we don't listen, because we don't want to listen. We don't want to change our ways. It even gets down to the housewife who can't be bothered to change the particular detergent she's using in her washing machine. And that detergent may be very bad for the environment, but she doesn't care. She doesn't interest herself in that. Just think about it. Has no sense of responsibility whatsoever, except to get her husband's shirts clean, which is very nice, of course. But there are detergents which are harmless. But when you get that, I had this experience in Buffalo, in New York State, a couple of years ago, and the town council of Buffalo was doing its very best to get people to use harmless detergents, and had enormous notices up on all the stores: buy this, buy this, buy that, and not the others. What happened? The housewives of Buffalo got in their motor cars, went over to Niagara Falls, which is not very far away, and bought the same old poisons that they were accustomed to. Now, where is the sense of responsibility there? No sense of responsibility. That's a fact, see. And people who spray everything, I suppose sprays go on in this country as they do in most countries. Spraying fruit, spraying fields of corn, spraying in horticulture and so on and so on. Everybody's spraying something. These caterpillars eating my apples, I must spray them. And again, I don't feel at all that sufficient thought is given to what is happening to that particular spray, the poison involved, when it goes into the soil, washed into the rivers, killing fish, going down to the ocean, killing more things and so on. We don't listen, and we don't really care because we don't have any sense of responsibility for our planet, which is the only planet we've got. It's the only home we've got in space. Why shouldn't we be interested in it? Why not? Isn't it, what is the lack of? Common sense? Are we all children? What's the matter with us that we're not interested in our planet? And yet, obviously, the majority of people are not. I think it's due to conditioning. We're all terribly conditioned, conditioned by our religion to start with. It's very difficult to have enough character for most people to escape sufficiently from their religious bonds in order to look at their religion objectively and try to see it as it is, and to try once again to think about it in relation to themselves and to find out whether you are entirely in agreement with it still, or whether you are still doing things you don't agree with, etc., etc. Most people are not free enough to do that. We're caught, especially as we're taught what we are taught in religion when we're quite young, and it is very, very difficult to escape from that conditioning. So to the extent that we are conditioned by religion, we are not free. We are conditioned by education, or our lack of it. Education, remember, is not education today, it is instruction, which is the opposite of education. Education means to bring out of each child what is in it, so that each child may become the beautiful, how shall I say, perfection of the seeds that it has within it. This child is going to grow into a rose, and this one into a lily, and this one into a peony, and this one into a carnation or what have you. But no, we don't do that to our children. We stuff into them instruction, instruere, stuff in everything we possibly can, whether it's useful or not. And so every child is, in a sense, choked. We're all like a plant which has not been allowed to grow properly. We are psychological cases to some extent. And it is something really for the wonderful resilience of human beings that they can become such splendid people, often enough, in spite of their education, not because of it. So here is something which conditions us, and we are all conditioned by it. So to that extent also, we are not free. We are conditioned by the media. We are conditioned by advertising, so that every one of us tends to buy the things that we've heard advertised on the television or the radio 100 or 1,000 times. That's what we go after. We are conditioned by politics, by what we read in the newspapers. Somebody said this, somebody else said that. You must vote for this, vote for that man. You must go to the right, you must go to the left, etc., etc. We are conditioned. We're all terribly conditioned people, and I believe there's a connection between the amount of conditioning that one has and one's freedom to accept his or her responsibility. Now, what is necessary, therefore, is, it seems to me, that there should be a very great emphasis put, perhaps all over the world, perhaps it must start in schools, on what I would call a philosophy of wholeness. Something which is putting the wholeness of things before the interests of the parts. A part can never be greater than the whole of which it is part. And that applies not only to mathematics, but to everything. There is no race, for instance, which is greater than humanity. Humanity contains all the races, and therefore any one race, which is only a part, can never be more important than the wholeness of humanity. But all too many people don't have that view. My race is better than his. Many, many races exist all over the world. They haven't yet learned the lesson. The same in the religious field. Truth is more important than any religion. Truth manifests itself through all the religions of the world, through all its many, many, many parts, many, many manifestations. But not one of those parts or one of those manifestations can be more important than truth itself, which is indescribable and beyond everything that we could even think of. And yet, we have people in different religions saying, I'm better than you, I'm better than you. We can't afford to be so stupid in 1977. It doesn't work any longer in this world of ours. It's too dangerous with atom bombs hovering around. We can't do that sort of thing anymore, and yet we're still doing it. Still doing it. The world is more important than any country. And yet you would think sometimes that countries feel they're more important than the world. At the United Nations itself, all the countries are battling for their own particular wants. Where are the statesmen who stand for the world? Put the world first, the good of the whole of humanity first, and the good of each particular race or religious group or nation second to that wholeness. Very few. I don't know how to find any, to tell you the truth. That is the world we're in. And yet, we have seen that little pea in space. It is a wholeness. It is one. And we are all part of that one. What we lack is a recognition of that fact in our own lives. So we continually act as though it were not true, and as though we can do exactly what we want at the expense of any other part of that same wholeness and get away with it. Well, gradually we're beginning to understand that you can't do that. You can't hoist the price of oil without every country in the world being affected. We've made one world economically. We've made one world with the mass media, but we haven't recognized it in our own hearts. And therefore, there is tremendous need, it seems to me, for a philosophy of wholeness. And that is really where theosophy comes into this picture, because theosophy is a philosophy of wholeness. Theosophy has always been presented from the point of view of, how shall I say, a suggestion, a hypothesis. It is a proposition offered for the thinking person to decide what he thinks about it. There is no need ever and no use ever to or in dogmatizing. We don't dogmatize either in this society. Sometimes we're very enthusiastic and appear to be dogmatic. But basically, this is something which is offered. It is offered to us as students and offered through us to a wider body of students in the world who may or may not be interested. Theosophy is always a challenge. It isn't something which sings you to sleep comfortably in an armchair. It is something which encourages you to go on and work further. So, if I mention these basic propositions, I will show how they are related to our published object and must then leave it to you. The first basic proposition mentioned by our founder, Madame H.P. Blavatsky, is simply in these words: an omnipresent, eternal, boundless, and immutable principle on which all speculation is impossible, since it transcends the power of human conception and can only be dwarfed by any human expression or similitude. Only one, that is being, shall we say. Everything else is ex-being, that is existence. Everything else is existence. You and I and everything we know and think. But central to all existence is being. And that being can be described as everywhere, omnipresent, eternal, having no beginning and no end, boundless, no frontiers or limitations of any kind, and immutable, changeless in itself, and yet the cause of change in all the manifestation. Now, can we live in relation to that idea? What does it mean? It means that we're all responsible to one another. It means we're all part of the same wholeness. There is only one, and I'm it, and so are you. And so is this bench, and so is the glass of water, and the flowers, and the house, and the car. Everything, visible or invisible, spirit, matter, consciousness, everything is part of that oneness. And everything is therefore related. Can one accept a philosophy of that nature? It's a challenge, because it would probably mean changes in your way of living. It is exemplified in the first object of the society, which you see written there, to form a nucleus of the eternal, of the universal brotherhood of humanity without distinction of race, creed, caste, sex, or color. As far as we're concerned, here, down on earth, everyone is a separate expression of the same unity. As we are all parts of that unity in our inmost nature, brotherhood, love, if you like, is the only possible way of living. And we go against it all the time and create problems for ourselves. Now, the idea of oneness can hardly be described, but I'm going to read you a few sentences which help us to establish the idea as a hypothesis. This boundless infinitude, that means timeless and limitless, you see, this boundless infinitude is everywhere, in all that is, in all that ever was, and all that ever will be, the fountain of everything, the ineffable source from which everything flows forth, and into which everything finally returns. All atoms and gods, all worlds and everything on and in them, boundless life, boundless space, boundless duration, frontierless and beginningless, and without limitations of any kind, because it contains them all. How can you describe this indescribable that? This principle includes both personalities and impersonalities, and is beyond both. It is not spirit, and it is not non-spirit, because it includes and is beyond both. It is not time, and it is not non-time, because it includes and is beyond both. And yet, it is the very core of the heart of each one of us, and indeed of every entity and thing in boundless infinitude. It is what we essentially are, as individuals and collectively. Call it cosmic intelligence, and you won't err. But in this case, it is not only the intelligence of a solar system, or of a galaxy, or of 1,000 billion galaxies, but all these and infinitely more. For nothing manifested, however vast, even approaches the ends of it, because it has no end. It is the selves, the essence of the gods, of the universes, of galaxies, of great spaces, of the great fields of frontierless space, all the inner worlds and all the outer worlds, all energy that is, all substance that is, all destiny that is, everything at all times, in all places and everywhere. How can you give a name to that? Well, I'm not going to try to give a name. God has so many commentations as a word. All religions would describe God differently. And so, in the theosophical philosophy, we have preferred to speak of a principle, that boundless, eternal, immutable, omnipresent principle. Everything, the only thing that is, containing all possible differences, even good and evil. Evil can't be outside it, because there isn't any outside. And so whatever we mean by evil, and we should all define it differently, I'm sure, if we were asked, it must be inside, because there isn't anywhere else for it to be. And perhaps it helps us a little if I read to you what I believe is a very interesting facet on this whole problem of good and evil. And it's supposed to be about Satan. Comes from Edward Carpenter's book, Towards Democracy, which I think appeared in 1883, so it's quite a long time ago. And so at last I saw Satan appear before me, magnificent, fully formed. Feet first, with shining limbs, he stood there erect, dark-skinned, nostrils dilated with passion. Fierce and scathing the effluence of his eyes, fierce the magnetic influence of his dusky flesh, his great foot well-formed, planted firm in the sand with spreading toes. Wonderful description of a tremendous being. This man believes in reincarnation, as you will see. "Come out," said Satan with a taunt. "Art thou afraid to meet me?" And I answered not, but I sprang upon him and I smote him. And he smote me 1,000 times, and brashed and scorched and slew me as with hands of flame. And I was glad, for my body lay there dead, but I sprang upon him again with another body. And he turned upon me and smote me 1,000 times and slew that body also. And I was glad and sprang upon him again with another body and another and again another. And the bodies which I took on yielded before him and were like cinctures of flame upon me, but I flung them aside. And the pains which I endured in one body were the powers which I wielded in the next. And I grew great in strength, till at last I stood before him complete, with a body like his own and equal in might. Then he ceased, and he said, "I love thee." And lo, his form changed, and he leaned backwards and drew me upon him, and bore me up into the air, and floated me over the topmost trees in the ocean, and round the curve of the earth under the moon, till we stood together again in paradise. I've always thought that was a very good description. You look at all those wheels on the cars out there. If it weren't for the friction of the road, they will never move. You couldn't move them without the friction. If it weren't for the problems and difficulties and trials and even temptations of life, we should never grow. We should just be remaining like cabbages in a row. So whatever you think of Satan, he has a job to do. I don't necessarily think he is really so wicked as he sometimes made up to be in some religious stories. But he has a very difficult job to do. Perhaps he has the hardest job of all, because in spite of doing all the dirty work, in his own heart of hearts, probably he has to remain pure. The whole question of good and evil is very interesting, and if there was really lots of time, I could deal with it. I'd like to suggest only that an Indian friend of mine, talking about this once, quite a few years ago, produced a stick. And he said, "This end is good and this end is evil." And he said, contrary to the Western view, theological view, that good and evil are opposing forces, he said, "I want to present to you with a different idea, that good and evil are the opposite ends of the same thing. But we don't have a name for that thing. We might transfer the picture to heat and cold. We have all the degrees of heat arising from zero, all the degrees of cold arising from zero. You can't say hot and cold are opposing forces exactly. They are the opposite ends of one and the same long range of temperature." And he was just transferring that picture to good and evil and suggesting that there was a point in the middle from which good, as it were, as we understand it, and bad, as we understand it, emerge. It is perhaps illustrative of how duality emerges from the oneness. Well, we won't go into that. I must get on. The second proposition that's put before us is to do with law. And here we are concerned to consider the plane that we've been describing, the plane of the oneness, the eternity of the universe as a boundless plane, periodically the playground of numberless universes, periodically manifesting and disappearing. And this further description of this involves us in laws of cycles, laws of periodicity, vibrations, if you like, and things of that sort, in suggesting to us that throughout the universe there is law, that everything within the universe acts and works according to law, a law which in the East is called karma, and which is basically a law of balance. When you upset the balance in one direction, then you are expected to put it right again. And I think if you think of that, it seems only justice. Any other way of function for that law would not really be justice, as it would, which would, I think, truly satisfy us when we're involved, and perhaps a little more evolved than we are at present. Now, can one accept that? Can we accept, and this is what it means, that everything we do, we're responsible for, that everything we think, we're responsible for, that everything we say, we're responsible for. Why? Because we say and do and think to others. And basically, we are each other. I am you, whether I like it or not. And whether you like it or not, you are me. Because we are all in the oneness. We are not only all part of the oneness, we all are the oneness. Because the oneness is in us, in every part of us. We are it. Therefore, we are all united again under the law. And when we act against the law, we have to put it right. Nobody else will really do it for us. Lots of people can help us. Lots of people can show us what to do. Lots of people can give us courage to face difficulties. All sorts of help can come from other people. But basically, we have to walk on our own feet and face the problems that we have created for ourselves. And that applies to the world of today. We have created the problems of the world, and we have to solve them. There is no one else to do it but you and me, and millions like you and me. And if we don't do it, what happens? Well, you know what happens. If we don't do anything about the problems, they get worse. And they will get worse like any other problem if we don't wake up and start to take a responsibility for what happens to our planet. Well, that second proposition that is laid before us as students to see what we think of it is mirrored in the second object of our society, which is concerned with law. We are asked to study comparative religion, philosophy and science in order to familiarize ourselves with the way law at an ethical, moral and physical level are working in those three fields. We are concerned to keep up with what is happening in the scientific world. Recently, some of you will have read that very interesting book, The Tao of Physics, which has appeared, and where the author seeks to show that from the basis of modern nuclear physics, the most modern discoveries in physics, you can move, as it were, to a point where you meet with the mystical experiences of the Orient in relation to their views of the views of each with regard to the fundamental, how shall I say, construction of the universe. And it's very interesting, this book, and it's well worth reading. And I understand that the Theosophical Bookshop in Auckland has already got, or has certainly ordered, a great many copies. There may even be some on the table at the back there, I don't know. Not yet, perhaps. I see a head wobbling over there. But when the opportunity comes, I suggest that many of you might like to get this book, as it really is one of the most marvelous bridges between mysticism on the one hand, the East on one hand, science and the West on the other. It's a remarkable achievement, I think. Then in the study of comparative religion, we are, of course, very ignorant. Supposing I ask a man on the streets of London, Paris, New York, Sydney, Auckland, perhaps, can you help me with a quotation? He'd probably say, yes, what is it? Who said this? Is there one maxim which should be acted upon throughout one's whole life? Yes, the maxim of loving kindness is such. Do not unto others what you would not they should do unto you. He would probably wrinkle his brows a little and say, yes, it sounds familiar. Yes, I suppose it's in the Bible. It doesn't sound to me quite like the words of Jesus, but must be in the Bible, of course. I don't remember who said it. Well, you put him out of his misery. And you say, well, as a matter of fact, I've suddenly remembered it was Confucius. And you say, oh, Confucius. Oh, well, of course, I suppose he bagged it from us. And then you have politely to point out that Confucius lived several hundred years B.C., of course. But there it is. And if you say that, you often meet, and I have had this happen to me, you meet with a certain resentment, you know, that people can be almost annoyed that anybody else said anything beautiful other than their particular religious hero, you see. It's a curious attitude. And yet, surely we should be growing into a different attitude where we rejoice exceedingly and are exceeding glad, as it thinks it says in the Bible. We are exceeding glad that all these teachings are available to everyone. And they are. I can take the golden stair, and if you want to get it, I can got the actual chapter and verse from Buddhism, hurt not others with that which pains yourself. That again is 500 years BC. Hebrew, even older. What is hurtful to yourself, do not do to your fellow man. Hinduism, just as much older. This is the sum of duty. Do naught to others which if done to thee would cause thee pain. Islam is more modern. No one of you is a believer until he loves for his brother what he loves for himself. Taoists, regard your neighbor's gain as your own gain, and regard your neighbor's loss as your own loss. Parsi religion, Zoroaster, very ancient. That nature only is good, when it shall not do unto another whatever is not good for its own self. It's all there in all the religions. The tragedy is that we don't know it, and even perhaps when we do know it, we don't do anything much about it. I would suggest that that should be in every school. In every school, everywhere. So that our children grow up with an appreciation of the other great faiths of the world, instead of being brought up, as they often are, in narrow-minded homes, where they are made to feel little spiritual snobs because they belong to this religion, which is better than all the rest. And that is still happening in many homes, all over the Western world especially. I must say the Orient is not free of it, but it is more tolerant, I think, mostly than the Christians. Can't afford it. I say it again. We can't afford it in 1977. We've got to build oneness, not create divisions, which we're so busy doing with that kind of an attitude. Don't we really want oneness? Don't we want friendliness, which will lead to peace and brotherhood? Everyone says yes, with one hand, and on the other hand, they're doing things which will destroy it. So there is a need to think, you see, and to be reasonable, and to take action. The third proposition is to do with the return home. Every religion has taught the return home, that if you follow a certain path, a certain way of life, you will find yourself on the way towards a reunion. Religory, religion, religory, bound back to your source, but to God by whatever name happens to be the God in your particular faith. In this case, one is concerned not with any particular God, but with the oneness principle of the universe, and that all souls can find their way home. And in the words of this, as it is presented to us, we are just given the idea of the fundamental identity of all souls with the universal oversoul, and the obligatory pilgrimage for every soul through a cycle of incarnation or necessity in accordance with cyclic and karmic law during the whole term. During the whole period of the existence of the universe, we are involved in this evolutionary scheme. And men, particularly, more easily perhaps than the life at a plant or an animal level, is able to find its way home if it wants to. And the third object of this society is to investigate the unexplained laws of nature and the powers latent in man. Laws in nature which are unknown to us are now being explored. I suppose you could say that once they could be explored, they're no longer unknown. But they are always, science and others, are always discovering new fields of research. And these interest us in our Theosophical Society, where we have quite a number of scientists at work who are theosophists on the one hand and scientists on the other, bridging the gulf which can exist but need not exist between two ways of thought. So you find in the world today this bridge being built. I've mentioned the Tao of Physics, which is one aspect of it. But you get things like the sensitivity of plants, the various types of healing that people are going in for today. I myself have seen the healers in the Philippines, and I have no answer to some of the things I've seen. Something might be a conjuring trick, but quite obviously much that I've seen is not a conjuring trick. There is the development of Kirillian photography, which is still in its infancy, but which is already beginning to show some results. And there are many other things, Yuri Geller and his spoons and so on. And science is beginning to investigate these things, which they never would have done 20 years ago. And this is a great step forward and of interest to students who are concerned with the unexplained laws. In the field of the powers latent in man, we have opening up before us the world of yoga, which is very well known in India and so little known in Western countries. Now, the part of yoga, which is called asanas, and to some extent pranayam, breathing exercises, has become known in the West. But that is not really yoga. It has no right, I feel, to call itself yoga when it leaves out the main part. And the main part of yoga really is that yoga is a philosophy. It is a way of life, which is an all-inclusive thing. And it means the ultimate, supreme experience of reunion of man with God. Consciously within himself, he knows that the drop has returned to the ocean, that the spark is reunited with the flame. Put it in whatever metaphor you wish. It is nothing less than that, yoga. And to simply a few exercises and call that yoga is ridiculous. And yet, that is what is happening in so many parts of the Western world today. In India, yoga is understood and it is reverenced because there can be no more supreme experience for the individual than to be reunited with his source. That is what we're here for. The whole purpose of our evolution is just that. And so you cannot treat it lightly. And it's not easy. Well, it's easy to do a few exercises. But to reach the totality of the possibility of reunion is certainly not easy and requires of the student all kinds of efforts which have to be made by himself and cannot be given him by anyone else. Temporary things can be given. Psychic experiences can be given sometimes. But the true spiritual growth must be made by the individual himself. And we confuse spiritual things and psychic things all too easily. One thing that I think is not at all understood in the West is the responsibility of the teacher. Now that is made abundantly clear in India, that if the teacher teaches the student something for which the student is not prepared, and the student makes a mess of it, harms himself or someone else, it is the teacher, under the law of karma, who is responsible, not the student. So that in the best schools of yoga, many of our Westerners find it rather tedious because they want to make a lot of progress quickly and they don't. They are watched sometimes for months and nothing happens because the teacher will not take the responsibility of teaching them until he knows just what they're like, what disciplines there are in the lives of these students. And if there are no disciplines, then he will start probably with disciplines. And if you take a very well understood and very well thought of, type of yoga like Patanjali, you will find that he starts off with disciplines. The first two steps in Patanjali, yam and niyam, are to do with disciplines. And in most places in the West, they don't even mention them. I've talked to people who say, oh yes, I'm a student of yoga, and they've never even heard of yam and niyam, never been mentioned to them as existing at all. It is rather absurd, you see. It's like taking a bit out of your body and thinking that's all it is. It isn't at all, it's a wholeness yoga. The disciplines of yam, for instance, include ahimsa. You have to face and deal with in your own life the challenge of ahimsa, which means harmlessness. That if you want to become one with the totality of the divine life, then you must so organize your own life that you do as little harm as you possibly can to any other form in which that life is incarnated. And that may mean a complete way, a change of your way of life. But in the West, it's not offered to the student. Brahmacharya. Part of yam, part of the first step. Brahmacharya means basically something like celibacy. It means basically no sex life. It is not enforced immediately as no sex life at all, but rather as a completely controlled sex life, in which the individual has understood that the force, the universal force, or the divine force that works through sex, the power of sex, is a divine force and has to be treated accordingly. with respect and reverence and not just for fun. And that is part of the first step in yoga. Absolute truthfulness is part of the first step in yoga, so that you will never tell a lie under any circumstances of any sort. Never, for the rest of your life. Not even a little white lie. Nothing. These are real challenges, and they're intended to be real challenges, because yoga is not to be played with, it is not to be toyed with. It is the ultimate way to complete freedom, moksha, salvation, whatever you like to call it. And I'm afraid in the West we play around with it, and a lot of people get into trouble because they do not practice sufficient disciplines to exercise some of the instructions that are conveyed to them by teachers who just don't know what they're doing. I've met people who have been and who are going and who are into mental homes, and people who are still out of mental homes but obviously going there quite soon. People get very affected by these things when they have no disciplines in their lives, and they go crazy. There are thousands and thousands of people in mental homes all around the world as the result of the so-called yoga they've been taught in the so-called yoga schools of the West. These teachers are nothing short of murderers, in my opinion. They have quite unreasonably, possibly for money, literally murdered some of these young people who will spend the rest of their lives suffering from psychic, not physical, psychic ailments in mental establishments. We really have got to try and understand the seriousness of yoga whilst being very happy that so many people are interested in trying to find a way home, which is ultimately what we all have to do. So these are the three main planks in the Theosophical Society's platform. You can go off along any direction of research, but never forget the oneness, which is central and basic and to which we all belong, inevitably. The law, which is also universal and from which nothing whatever is exempt. There are no exceptions. It's no good saying it's affecting so-and-so, but it won't hurt me. It will hurt you in one way or another, because you, like him and everyone else, are responsible under the law for what you do. And if you do stupid things against the law, then you will inevitably have to put them back, and that will be uncomfortable. But when the time comes for you to put them back, don't blame the individual through whom that particular tiresome happening occurs to you. That person is no more responsible than a wall is responsible when I hit a tennis ball at it and it comes back at me. I don't blame the wall, do I? I know that if I send out a tennis ball against a wall, it'll come back. I know that. That is the law. When someone sends something back to you, don't blame that person. That person's only the wall, that's all. And how often we say, he was unkind to me, she gossiped about me, he underbid me, or whatever it may be. They're all walls, that's all. It is you who sent out a tennis ball. Now, can you accept that? It's not always easy to accept, but then why should it be? If this is part of the way out, the final way out for everyone, why should it be so easy as all that? So Theosophy offers that second idea, the inevitability and the universality of law. And finally, the very, very hopeful possibilities of our removing ourselves finally, shall we say, from this scene by taking the trouble and making sufficient effort by following what rules and suggestions can be discovered for you and me, following them through a path of true yoga and meditation to the final realization of oneself as part of the divine life of the universe. And that is the end. That is, as it were, the passing out exam of this great world school in which we have been at school for probably thousands and thousands of years, in various classrooms called races, in studying various subjects called religions. We've been black and yellow and brown and white. We have studied subjects, Islam, Hinduism, Buddhism, Zoroastrianism, Taoism, Christianity. All the world has to, we'll have to find out all the world has to teach us in order that we may finally take the exam, which is an exam to do with our own personal inner realization of the brotherhood of man and the oneness of life. And that takes us out of the school. Now, that is why the Theosophical Society was founded, to try and put forward these ideas, which are full of hope, to the student who is really interested in taking his world and his life seriously. And if more people would do something of this sort, develop a philosophy of wholeness based on the inner understanding and upon the outer understanding of this little ball in space, then perhaps when we come to the crossroads, which may not be very far ahead of us, we will turn in the direction of happiness and peace and not in the direction of destruction and war. It is up to us. Thank you.